Hello, I'm Michael Hintz with another Table Talk on Vision Australia Radio, the home of lifestyle radio, and it's hello from my producer, Mark Ridout. Today it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Russell Keast, head of the Centre for Advanced Sensory Science at Deakin University, who recently published a peer-reviewed paper which explored the tongue's ability to detect fat as a distinct taste. I never thought I'd be interviewing someone about fat. I mean, we spend our lives trying to avoid it, don't we? In effect, claiming that fat is the sixth taste. So, Russell, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Now, I'm sorry for this pun, and I can't resist it. Before we chew the fat, as it were, tell me a little bit about yourself, your career as a sensory scientist, because you don't meet many, I mean, you meet a lot of sommeliers and baristas and MasterChef contestants, but sensory scientists, I think you're the first one I've met. Tell us about it, what you do and how that affects our everyday lives.
Sure. Well, I fell into this role, I was prior to my university days, actually trained as a chef, so had an interest in food, worked in some restaurants in New Zealand, and decided I wanted to know a little bit more. So I actually went and did a university degree in food science and nutrition just to learn a little bit more about the background of food, and I've pretty much stayed in universities ever since. So the interest in food and in flavour in particular was developed during my PhD. And then when I went and did postdoctoral research over in the USA,
Where was that in the USA?
In Philadelphia.
In Philly. Yes.
Lovely place, lovely place. And I spent 5 years there and really developed up the area of sensory and how we perceive things, the sense of taste, the influence it has on how we consume or, you know, does it have an influence on what we consume? And there's a whole lot of nutrition that goes, or let's say underpins our sense of taste. So things like sweetness informs us about carbohydrate or sugars in the diet.
Yes.
Umami.
Umami, that's an interesting one, isn't it?
It is, the fifth taste.
Yes.
And that informs us about the protein levels in foods, and that also brings up an interesting story on MSG, and you know, there's a lot of public awareness of what MSG is, but there's also a lot of misconceptions about the role of MSG.
MSG is, for those that don't know,
monosodium glutamate.
Right.
Monosodium glutamate, and you'll see a lot of advertising around sometimes where you've got MSG free. You know, no added MSG.
Yes.
And this goes back to, you know, a paper that was published in the 1960s in the US from a doctor who had eaten at a Chinese restaurant and said, gee, he suffered from hot flushes after, and he published this anecdotal account in a very good journal. And it took off from there that MSG may be bad. However, there's been absolutely no blinded evidence that MSG has any form of allergy inducement whatsoever.
Oh, that's good. Well, MSG notwithstanding, and that is an interesting fact, so some people can rest easy now, so shoot on down to your local Chinese and... being a doctor who first dined at the Chinese, he probably bought the whole restaurant.
That's right, yes.
Now, let's put this identification of fat as the sixth taste into context.
Yes.
Taste is a much more complex and diverse subject than a cursory first glance suggests. Something we often take for granted, like the nose at the end of our face, until we taste something extremely foul or bitter, that is. For most, a basic taste encompasses sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and as you said before, umami, perhaps best described as savoury and prevalent in, you know, meat and truffles, and some say anchovies. Now you claim fat, and some, including Charles Spence, who is the co-author of a book called The Perfect Meal, The Multisensory Science of Food and dining, add other tastes such as metallic or even electric. Being electric, the taste of electric, that's like taking a bite out of, claims Spence, a Sichuan flower or a peppercorn.
Yes.
Now, tell us all about this taste, because we describe taste in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6, benchmarks, but before, going back in history, in the history of taste, tell us a little bit about that, because, some claim there are up to 20 different tastes.
Yes, look, and it's been, the history of taste is incredibly fascinating, and in terms of the written literature, we really go back to Aristotle, who claimed there were 7 tastes. Now, we think back in terms of history and what he was doing, he was identifying what was happening in the mouth.
Yes.
And everything that was happening in the mouth that was sort of independent of the nose.
Yes.
And what we can perceive through the sense of smell was a taste. Over the subsequent centuries, hundreds of people, scientists have worked in the area of taste. And as you say, there's been hugely diverse lists in terms of what a taste is.
Not a bit of a plot by you academics to keep yourself in a job,
I think
is it?
It could be. I think it could be. Yes. But when we get to the 1940s and there was a great advance in technologies and our ability to understand, let's say, a little more of the biology or physiology of the sense of taste.
Yes.
A new framework was put in place, and it was saying that it's not really what we perceive in the oral cavity, but if there was neural networks to the brain from taste cells. And so anything on a taste cell that activated the nerves that go to the brain, to the taste processing
region.
Now,
the taste cells are on the tongue, aren't they?
They are, yes.
And how many of them does the average tongue have?
Lots and lots, thousands of taste cells. So taste cells are held together in taste buds.
Yes.
Taste buds are held on papillae. So we've got papillae at the front, sides, and back of the mouth.
Yes.
So depending on – and those are physical structures or anatomical structures.
Yes.
And there's variance. And I may have a lot, you may have a little. You know, somebody may have in between. So there is great variance in terms of those anatomical structures that we actually have on the tongue.
Right.
But anything on those taste cells,
yes,
which activates those centers of the brain, potentially is a taste.
Right.
And there's a number of criteria that have to be met. So,
people often get mixed up between taste and flavor, don't they?
Yes.
Those words get intermingled.
Interchanged, yes.
Yes, and you obviously taste a flavor. A flavor is what you taste.
That's right. The taste, again, from our perspective, will be just what's happening from the taste cells.
Yep.
If we're just talking, yes, I'm tasting a wine, that would be the flavour of the wine. But again, those are semantical differences.
Wine tasting is very interesting because the language of wine tasting is very narrow, of course. I've got a fairly sensitive snoz, and my olfactory part of it is very sensitive, and you taste a lot of that with your nose, don't you?
Yes,
and then degrees
absolutely.
Of sweetness with your tongue. It's very interesting. Now, how did you come to do this research into looking into fat? Because I have interviewed, I think, someone you'd know, a previous guest on the show, Jennifer McGlagan.
Yes,
also an ex-Melburnian. Well, you're an ex.
Yes.
You're from New Zealand, but Jennifer's originally from here, now lives in Toronto. She's written a book about things we usually shun in cooking, namely Fat and Bones, very interesting cookbook.
That's right.
And latterly, and I interviewed her recently about this, and will replay her interview shortly because of popular demand. She very eloquently describes the world's most dangerous flavour, and that's bitter.
Yes. It's a fascinating book.
Interesting book, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It is. It's a great read.
Who'd think that you'd buy a book? You know, you're wandering along the bookshelves. There's a book, Bitter.
That's right.
I've got to buy a book on bitter.
That's right. And it's, you wouldn't think you would be having a cookbook based on bitter, but it is. It's fascinating.
So what's your take on those books and what Jennifer has done?
I think what Jennifer's done is wonderful in terms of having a written and very well written book on, let's say, a topic such as bitter, which is accessible to the population. A lot of the stuff that I do maybe in very much an academic field and independent of consumers and let's say readability for consumers.
Right.
But I think what Jennifer's done is really bring it to the population. I think it's a fantastic book.
Yes.
I've got it
yes.
on my coffee table, my lounge coffee table at the moment. So
oh, right. Oh,
it's
good.
Very nice.
Good. Now, outside the realms of academia, taste is largely subjective, isn't it? So what are the practical outcomes of sensory science? And how do, what are the long-term potential applications that will trickle down and translate into common relevance or acceptance? And the other thing is, are you funded by any food companies or is your research independent?
I'll answer that first.
Right.
So I've done work and continue to do work with Mars in the UK primarily.
Right.
They've got a fantastic centre there for doing research, and we've done some fat taste work with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also funded by the NHMRC, so the National Health and Medical Research Council.
Right.
So both both public and private funding for the research, and that's because the outcomes of the research both have benefits for the food supply and also benefits for population or public.
What public health benefits are there?
Yes,
I mean,
it
seems an obvious question to ask, but I mean,
Let's save the fat taste research as a good example. The work we've done in being able to identify fat as a taste is also linked with what happens when we consume too much fat.
Yes.
Or why do people consume too much fat?
Now, when we talk fat, there's good fat and bad fat, isn't there?
Trans fat is bad fat.
Trans fat is bad fat? What's trans fat?
Trans fat is not highly found in nature. So it's
right.
a non-natural form.
Artificial.
So something that's
yeah.
been a liquid fat
yes.
turned to a solid fat usually involves some form of modification of what would be the natural configuration of the fat. And that...
I'm trying to keep up here now because fat's got a bit like my footy club. Fat's got a bad... Or politicians.
Yes.
Fat's got a bad name, hasn't it? And we're only now just starting to realise there are good fats and bad fats. And not all the ills attributed to the world and health are due to fat or indeed overconsumption of sugar, for that matter. We're now starting to explore, rationalise this a bit, aren't we?
Things like omega-3s,
yes.
Have positive effects on health. But generally, our problem with fat has been overconsumption. Obviously, trans fats, we can put them into a separate category, but the majority of the issues that we have with fats is related more to overconsumption. There's also, as you're saying, the types of fat, so we could go with higher levels of omega-3, less levels of omega-6 maybe in the diet in terms of a ratio. But a very simple message would be to limit intake. And if we limited our intake, we would solve a great deal of the diet-related problems that we currently have.
But aren't you like Don Quixote's tilting at the windmill? Because we're brought up on diets of highly processed food, and that surely must affect not only our health and what we eat and our lifestyle, but it also affects how we perceive taste. Because if we've brought up, and Jennifer made this point very well succinctly in her book, that she was tasting a grapefruit one day, and it was a sweet grapefruit. And when she was a child, grapefruits were bitter.
That's right.
And her point was we're manufacturing or altering foodstuffs, and a lot of foodstuffs are processed, because we start out with a huge disadvantage or bias. And is the work you're doing Does that sometimes frustrate you because you feel as though the message is not getting through and you're just sort of pecking around at the edges?
Look, and you never really know what message is going to take off. And going back to the MSG example, that's a prime example of a message that just had legs and has wide public appeal these days.
Yep.
I fully expect that the foods we eat aren't as they were 10,000 years ago, when our main purpose was to get enough energy to survive.
Yes.
We've developed the food supply to meet our taste and our response to taste. So,
is this part of a kickback? Sorry, while they're talking about paleo diets and all that sort of nonsense.
Nonsense.
Is it?
Yes. Yes, that's right. So
cavemen diets.
Yeah, look, I find it...
My producer Mark's jumping up and down. He's on a paleo diet at the moment. It's all beer, I think.
No, so if we go back in time, what we've done is we've developed the food supply to suit our appetite.
Yes.
But our appetite is really an evolutionary relic, which said if we were hunter and gathering around, we found something with sugars, immediate forms of energy, we needed that appetite of response to tell us to consume it. Something like if it was bitter, you know, obviously it had the potential to cause harm, so don't eat it. So we had very simple messages, either
or if it was badly cooked. Or Brussels sprouts were bitter, but they were, you know, our parents soaked the life out of them, and they were just like eating sort of green blotting paper something.
That's right, just poorly cooked. So our appetite of our food supply has changed to suit our appetite, but our appetite doesn't do what it was meant to do. However, the worst thing that you can do is just go back in time and say that we're only going to eat for nutrition. We eat for pleasure.
Oh, yes.
And we have to eat for pleasure. And then all it comes down to is still eat for pleasure. You know, we can hopefully produce better foods that are more nutritious and yet retain the appetite of qualities. But we just need to eat less. And that is an incredibly simple message that would put a lot of people out of business if in fact, we could eat less.
There we go. Yes, the economics of it. In Spencer's, he co-authored the book, The Perfect Meal, he highlights the growing awareness of multi-sensory stimuli on food appreciation, such as the way the food is presented. You often go out for dinner and you see that the restaurant and the chefs put an enormous amount of work into the way the food is presented. And I think this started really with back in the 60s with Nouvelle Cuisine. The ambiance, or that's a flash way of saying the atmosphere, everything. The cutlery, the setting, the crockery, the company, the sound, and the role of technology. And he uses such terms as neurogastronomy. What's this all about?
Yeah. Look, it's very fascinating, but it is about the whole experience and using all of our senses and directing at the food. And I think it's a very good point in terms of consumption. If we think about what we're eating a little bit more, we will probably be a lot more aware of cues that our body's having to what we're eating as well. And they're not just necessarily, gee, that's good, I love the look of it, the auditory texture that you may be seeing, the look of the food, the aromas, the tastes, everything combined. But also the signals that your body's giving you, like, I've had enough, I've had this portion here, which was enough to satisfy me. I don't need to finish off absolutely everything because
if we're discovering the art of conversation, because you go out these days and people are so busy taking photos of their food and texting and all that sort of thing. They live on social media. But You ever notice how quickly they eat their food?
As if
their life depended on it. That must have enormous health ramifications down the track.
That's right. And I've got to say, I'd put my hand up and say that I sometimes, you know, you'll sit down and you'll just eat far
too
quickly.
You're really hungry.
And then you realise, you think, good grief, it was only 5 minutes ago that I sat down with a full plate and I've already finished it. So it does take, and these behaviours are really hard to change. Yes. Once they're ingrained in you and you are a quick eater, to be able to slow down takes a lot of conscious effort.
And you
just slip back into the habit that you've developed over the years. So young and children, it's very important to develop those habits up at an early age, and then hopefully they can carry through into adult life.
So what about the eating artificial foodstuffs derived from reconstituted DNA? Because food security is a major issue going forward, and us people in Western cultures shy away from eating insects, whereas billions of people survive on insects. And there's talk about eating reconstituted hamburgers made from the DNA samples of artificially created beef and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
What's happening with all that?
I think it's an interesting development. I think it was Darwin who said, you know, a lot of the problems planets would be solved if we went to a vegetarian diet.
Was Darwin a vegetarian? I bet you he wasn't.
I bet he wasn't.
Those people preach all these things, tell you to do one thing, go out and... I'm getting political again. Sorry, Charles.
That's exactly right. Yep. There's a lot of things we can do to ensure that in the coming years there is food security, but technology is going to play a big role in the next 20 years to see what is
what's going to happen. What's your prediction quickly for the next 20 years? Because we've got about 5 minutes left. Give us a look into the future of what we'll be eating.
If I knew, I'd give up my job and start doing it.
Give us a guesstimate.
Look, I think...
Take your academic self off now. This is just you.
I think the thought of genetic modification and the way it's done will start to change. So it'll be more along the lines of a breeding program as opposed to the thought of taking a foreign gene and putting it into a plant and helping it grow. So I think there'll be changes in that aspect which will help crops grow, maybe in places where they haven't been able to grow before. And let's say with Australia and the land mass, which is certainly unusable, technologies to get water into those areas, and also technologies to help grow crops more stable. There's got to be a lot of work done on waste.
Well, we have technologies for the desalination plant, which is costing the taxpayer a lot of money sitting down
doing nothing.
But people are a bit, there's genetic engineering coming into the human, which has frightening implications philosophically. But so this is going to go through what we not only... how we reproduce ourselves, but into what we eat.
I think so, and it may not be. There may be different stages where some of the food is given to the developing world where there is crises, and do you do it or do you let them fend for themselves? So I'm not necessarily saying in terms of a developed world like Melbourne will be encouraging the organics movement, they will still
continue
to flourish.
We'll all be choking in 20 years' time in Melbourne. The freeways will be clogging with all the carbon, but we won't be able to move. Look, a very quick question before, and it's been fascinating talking to you. What do you make of the current preoccupation come obsession, I call it food porn, with food and eating, or maybe entertainment, as exemplified by the spate of reality TV shows like My Kitchen Rules, MasterChef, and all these sort of things, which seem to be a good platform for the judges, but which the contestants are becoming increasingly Bogan-like, I think.
Yes. Look, I've got a view that in anything which promotes our food knowledge, our food literacy...
is a good thing.
Starts to become important because...
But the price we pay Some of these shows are execrable.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to.
You haven't been a contestant on one.
No, I haven't been a contestant.
All right. Well, look, Russell, thank you very much. We've skated over the surface of the issue, but look, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you, Michael. It's
very
a pleasure.
Fascinating. Russell, as I say, enjoy your further research, and I hope to speak to you in the future, maybe not on air, but off air about this, because it's a fascinating subject.
Thank you, Michael.
You're listening to I've Just Missed Table Talk on Vision Australia Radio with me, moi, Michael Hintz, and producer, the urbane Mark Ridout. I'll be back shortly with Heard It Through the Grapevine. And my research material was sourced from The Age and The Washington Post.